In today's media landscape, you can look at the wealth of news channels, television networks, and cable outlets and more, and count almost all of their respective owners on one hand. My guest says that this is a problem for democracy, and we'll find out why he thinks so this hour. We'll also discuss a recent court ruling that struck down regulations that require internet providers to treat all traffic the same. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest this hour is Michael Copps, a former chair and commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission. He's a special advisor to Common Cause's Media and Democracy Reform Initiative and a Milwaukee native. He spoke last night in Madison as part of an event called Defeating Dollarocracy, the Importance of Community Media. We'll take your questions and comments this hour about the state of media in the United States and how you feel about how it affects democracy. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Michael Copps, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back in Wisconsin. It's even greater to be on Wisconsin Public Radio, so it's wonderful.
Happy to have you. Well, as I mentioned, you spoke last night here in town, and give us a little bit of a synopsis for our statewide audience as to what message you wanted to get out there.
Well, I did. We were here to talk about the importance of community media, community radio, and media that really reflects the diversity of our communities and our people. And there was a session called Defeating Dollarocracy last night. That's a wonderful term coined by author Robert McChesney and journalist John Nichols in their new book, Dollarocracy, which I really strongly recommend. So we had a program last night, and they spoke, and your illustrious congressman, Mark Pocan, was there and gave a wonderful talk also. But what we're here talking about really is the state of our media in this country, which has really worried me. Since before I joined the Federal Communications Commission in 2001, I served there for about 10 years. And I was there during really a difficult time for democracy. It was under, it's not usually a partisan place, but on some issues it breaks down in partisan fashion. And media consolidation and media ownership was one of those issues. So what concerned me was that we were losing so many community, independent, family-run stations that were being taken over by huge corporate media titans, whether it be Clear Channel or Rupert Murdoch or you name it. So you were getting really a handful of stations, and when you were getting along with that, consolidation was kind of a when these stations combine, they have to finance these transactions. They're looking for economies to pay for the deal, and the first thing they do is go in and cut the newsroom, shutter the newsroom or combine it and downsize the number of journalists working for it. And over the course of time, that has a disastrous effect, really, on our democratic dialogue because it means that investigative reporting is downsized. Investigative reporting is hanging by a life thread. And we don't fuel the civic dialogue that we should be having, that small d democratic dialogue that citizens in a self-governing democracy must always have for themselves. And what concerned me at the FCC was these deals all have to be approved when broadcasting stations combine or newspapers and broadcast stations combine. And the FCC, like industry, seemed to have fallen in love with this industry consolidation. So there was seldom a time when a deal came that it didn't approve that deal. And at the same time, the FCC was beginning, going through a long process of eliminating public interest guidelines that the commission had on their books that they could use to make licenses accountable, licensees and broadcast stations accountable to their communities.
You mentioned a reduction in things like independent investigative reporting. Do you see, though, a resurgence of that in other media, like community radio stations or local access TV?
Not what I'd like to see, no. I think McChesney and Nichols in their book estimate that we've probably lost 30% of our resources devoted to journalism since the beginning of the century. There's column in the New York Times this morning, as recent as this morning, by David Carr, saying newspaper staffs have lost 30% of their reporters since the year 2000. And I think the hope was that new media would come in and pick up those people. The community media would flower and blossom, but we haven't created the conditions for that to happen. So it's been a huge net loss, and we've got too many journalists who are walking the streets looking for a job rather than pounding the beat following a story. And you can't survive in a democracy without that kind of in-depth journalism that holds powerful people and powerful institutions accountable. The last time I checked, and it's been a year or two since I did this, there were 26 states in the United States of America that did not have a reporter accredited to Capitol Hill. Now stop and think about what that means for a minute. With all the decisions that are up for grabs and all the issues in Washington, D.C., and they're not being covered, and people back home aren't hearing about them. And the same thing happens for state capitals. You know, so much of the action now, Congress isn't legislating all that much because they can't agree on anything. So a lot of the action has fallen to state legislatures now, and there's a lot of corporate money, special interest money, going in to influence state legislatures. And in my field, for example, in communications, I'm a big advocate of getting broadband out to everybody in the country, because I think it's something you have to function as a productive citizen, find a job, take care of yourself, educate yourself and your kids. You have to have that high-speed broadband. A lot of states have passed laws saying we're going to prohibit communities from building their own municipal broadband, even when the big internet service providers don't want to service that area. AT&T might not want to go there because they can't cherry pick. It's not profitable enough for them, or Verizon or Comcast, one of the big companies. So a lot of these municipalities say, well, we'll build our own then, because we understand how important this is to the future of our community. But a lot of special interest money has gone into the American Legislative Exchange Council and others who draw up these bills that seem to pass more and more state legislatures, and they have prohibited like 20 states now from, or made it hugely difficult for 20 states to build municipal broadband. So what happens to those communities? Business isn't going to go there. Business doesn't want the municipalities to do it because someday it might be profitable for them to come back. So they're disserved. And that's why the United States of America is doing so poorly when it comes to getting broadband out to all of its citizens, no matter who they are or where they live or what the individual circumstances of their lives may be.
Internet as a medium, though, is probably one of the most lower-D democratic in that so long as you have access to it, the world is at your fingertips. How has the market adjusted now with regards to media ownership and the proliferation of the internet?
The market has taken the internet down the same road that every other communication system in the history of the country has gone down: radio, television, cable. I love the internet. You love the internet. We're all on it all the time. And like you say, it's everybody has access. Barriers to entry are low. Wonderful entrepreneurship. Wonderful innovation. But in point of fact, what you're seeing now is the coming of powerful companies providing access to the internet, limiting access, putting themselves in gatekeeper control, charging too much for poor internet service. And it's not getting the job done. And you're seeing even on the internet the growth of these huge companies who are aggregators, who take you where they want to take you, maybe, rather than where you want to go. So I see that internet's I see danger signals for that internet. It's going down roads we have to be very, very careful of if we're not going to lose the opportunity creating potential of this technology. It's probably the most opportunity-creating technology in the history of mankind since the printing press. And you don't compete, I think, as a citizen against citizens in other countries, or if you live in rural Wisconsin, against people in the big cities, without having access to that high-speed broadband. You can't get a job anymore. You know, you don't send in your resume anymore to a company and say, I'm applying for this job. The big companies don't even look at that. They do everything online. More and more, we're going to take care of ourselves and our health with telemedicine. If we're going to solve problems of energy dependence, it's going to be through internet and broadband. It's so critically important. But if we allow a few big companies to come in and get a stranglehold on that, and there are signs of this happening, and we don't assert some public interest oversight over how it develops, then we are short-circuiting our broadband future, and we're short-circuiting the future of our country competitively in the global markets, and we're short-circuiting our democracy.
Six companies own the vast majority of the prolific cable networks that we have, the TV networks that we have, the radio networks that we have. We have a wealth of options as consumers in terms of what we want to watch or listen to or to surf on the internet, yet only six companies own all of, you know, most of these things. What is the biggest problem with that arrangement in your mind?
Well, I hear all the time, why are you so concerned about this? I've got 500 channels and all of this, but it's kind of the analogy, same message, but one ventriloquist, you know, and you're talking about six ventriloquists. It's the same kind of stuff. And it's not just politics, but it's culture and entertainment, too. You can get in your car in Los Angeles, California, and drive to the East Coast, turn on the radio, and you're going to hear pretty much the same kind of music wherever you go, although you're passing through all these wonderful, cultural, rich, regional areas where there's different genres of music and all of that. And we're kind of pushing all that stuff aside. And it's even worse when you get to the news, because what you're getting in place of in-depth journalism, because of all of the cuts that we've incurred, you're getting just a lot of glitzy infotainment. That doesn't really inform. It may be entertaining and all that, but it's not good for you. It's sort of like, you can't go to McDonald's every day. It's nice to go there once in a while, but it's not a healthy diet to go there every day of the week. And that's kind of the case with our media now. The country can't get by on a McDonald's diet.
So what's your solution?
Well, I think there's a number of things that need to be done. Number one, the FCC has to be able to start saying no to some of these consolidation deals. This isn't the past. It's going on right now. Just several weeks ago, they approved another tranche of big media transactions involving Tribune and Sinclair and Gannett. And, of course, a couple of years ago, there was this huge Comcast-NBCU merger, which I think was just absolutely daunting when you stop to think about it. It was broadband and broadcast. It was traditional media as well as new media. It was content as well as distribution. And I looked at that and I said, this is just too much power to give any one company in the United States of America. But I was the one dissenting vote on the FCC, and it sailed through. Hmm. So that's number one. Start saying no. Number two is let's get active, and I know you want to talk about this a little bit later, and making sure we have an open internet freedom, net neutrality, and that's a whole other story I know you want to talk about. But the FCC has the deciding role that it should be playing right now to guarantee that future of the internet. And then we've got to just bring back that idea of public oversight of some public oversight of our media environment. That was the whole basis of broadcasting in the first place. And now that so many of our communications are moving to the internet, we have to stop and think about what are the public interest obligations of some oversight on the internet. Not get in this debate about regulating or not regulating the internet. That's not the question. The question is who is going to be in control of your online experience when you go on the internet. There's going to be some gatekeeping company that can ration out to you at very high cost what they want you to be seeing and hearing, or are you, as a citizen and as a consumer, going to be in control of it? So those are some of the things that flying at 30,000 feet that the Federal Communications Commission needs to do. And to do that, it has to have an injection of true feel for the public interest in reflecting the diversity of the country that we live in. People of color in the United States of America, minorities, Well, I already said now about a third of our population, be a majority by the middle of the century, probably. You know how many full-power commercial television sets stations? How many full-power commercial television stations minorities, people of color, diversity groups own? It's like 3%. Hmm. Now, should we be surprised then that minorities are so often caricatured and stereotyped on radio and on television? Should we be surprised that their issues get such short shrift? I mean, if it wasn't for public media, there'd be almost none at all. So we've got to do something about that, and that's all part and parcel of what I'm talking about. What we have to just look at this is we have this one big media ecosystem. And it's partly the traditional media of newspapers, radio, television, cable. It's partly new media. And it's not one against the other, or it's not working on one and ignoring the other. It's repairing the whole thing and making sure that it is serving the people. And when we're talking about broadcasting and the public airways, that we go back to that original deal that was made in 1934, you, the broadcaster, get free use of the airwaves that belong to the people. But in return for that, you serve the public interest. You inform people. You provide news and information, and you reflect cultural diversity.
We're talking with Michael Copps. He's a former chair and former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission. He's a special advisor now to Common Cause's Media and Democracy Reform Initiative. He spoke last night in Madison as part of an event called Defeating Dollarocracy, the Importance of Community Media. And we invite you to join the conversation this hour. What are your thoughts, your outlook on the state of media in the United States and on net neutrality? We'll get to that as well this hour. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, and you can also comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the state of U.S. media with Michael Copps. He's a former commissioner and former chair of the Federal Communications Commission and special advisor to Common Core's Media and Democracy Reform Initiative. He spoke last night in Madison at an event called Defeating Dollarocracy. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Michael, before the break, you were talking about some of the perils, I suppose, of having so much media owned by so few corporations. But I wanted to ask, why punish success? If in the free market, success is provides you the opportunity to continue to buy out your competition, what's wrong with that?
I want to ensure success. I want to ensure competition. I want to ensure the ability of people who want to be a part of media to have some decent shot at being a part of the media and not find the doors of opportunity slammed in their face. Nobody's trying to change the ethic or the dynamic force of capitalism here. I think our country made that decision long ago that media was going to be part of the system of capitalism. And the internal and inherent dynamic, I think, of capitalism is to build market control, is try to get gatekeeper control. And that's all well and good until you get to the point where you have basically imposed a monopoly or a duopoly or an oligopolistic situation, and then the public interest has to come to the fore. What these companies want now, and they're very bold in saying it, you know, Verizon is saying, you know, we can block stuff on the internet. We have freedom of speech. Well, what kind of a rationale is that? So if we're going to avoid monopoly and avoid this kind of gatekeeper control, there has to be an assertion of the public interest. And we have managed at critical times, especially in the last century, in the Progressive Era and the New Deal, to assert the public interest when it's needed. If you're going to have monopoly, you have to have, and duopoly, there's got to be some regulatory oversight. You can't have both monopoly and no regulation, although that's what a lot of these companies want right now, because that's just Katie by the door and there's going to be no competition anywhere, and it's going to be the whole economy under the control of a few people, which we're getting closer and closer to in the United States of America. So the kind of thing I'm talking about, media democracy, that means just what it said. It's to foreclose the possibility of all of this gatekeeping and monopolistic control and gatekeeper control, and give innovation and give competition and give democracy a shot.
Let's take a call from Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I couldn't agree with your guest more. I have been a long advocate of open access to media, particularly after the Telecom Act of 1996 was passed, which I think was sponsored by the congressman from the Madison area. I can't remember his name, but he beat it, Bob Kastenmeier. A few items. First of all, the public airwaves are open to all citizens who want to view a radio station's public files. And I've had the occasion to stop in at a radio station unannounced and ask to see their public files and was denied because of various reasons. And when I contacted the FCC, they were very hostile to the public and made excuses for the radio stations, which gave me a very strong sense that the FCC was definitely controlled by the media, and it was really disheartening. But two things that I think were the death knell of open access radio: the Fairness Doctrine, which was destroyed during the Reagan administration, which allowed these conglomerates to take over the media, and then the Telecommunications Act, which actually, you talked about minority ownership. One of the former Green Bay Packers, Willie Davis, had purchased four radio stations, and in his book he talks about how this Telecommunications Act just about put him and his business out of his radio stations out of business because of competition. But one last word, there's a radio station in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, WOMT, which has a wonderfully fresh open mic where they just allow their callers to call in, and it's not the right-wing radio station, it's not a left-wing radio station, and they let people just have at it, which is what we used to have in public in our radio airwaves. We had fairness. You can say whatever you want, but you also have to give time to opposing viewpoints, and that has been decimated for the last 20 years by the, I call it the rant radio stations.
Thanks, Mike. Okay, great. Thanks. We've got your point, and I'll let Michael Copps respond.
Great. It's great to talk to another Mike from Milwaukee, because I'm Mike from Milwaukee, too, or I was long ago. That's a sad but all too true story, I think, that you relay about the reaction of the FCC to citizen complaints. A lot of complaints get filed. Not many of them get acted upon. You're also right on target when you talk about one of the central purposes of the airwaves was to provide access to people and access to antagonistic points of view. We're supposed to have a clash of opinion, hopefully based on accurate facts and all of that, a clash of opinion, and some opportunity given for the expression of viewpoints on the other side, and that's what we're trying to work for. You're correct in observing that the Telecommunications Act sparked a lot of consolidation, but I would also argue that the FCC probably took it farther than the Telecommunications Act even. I don't think when the Telecommunications Act of 1996 was passed that anybody envisioned that consolidation was going to go to the ridiculous, ludicrous lengths to which it has gone, with so few companies exerting so much power. I think the Telecommunications Act actually said some positive things about encouraging competition, but what happened after the act was passed was the big telecom companies took it to court and got some of what they didn't like really changed judicially, and the commission itself, overly responsive, I think, and I'm not saying this was terribly insidious. I think there are a lot of people who sincerely believe in the free market approach, and that somehow, you know, broadband, for example, is going to magically be built in every area of the country, even when there's no business case for business to go. But the FCC was captive to this mentality, as much as it was captive to special interests per se. That's a debate that goes on. Now, I'm hopeful under the new commission that we have now, we have a new chairman, that there will be some steps taken toward a reaffirmation of the public interest. He's said some promising things already, but we have to see what the actual action is going to be. What are they going to do on net neutrality and the open internet? What are they going to do about media ownership going forward? And that will be when we have a better idea of what direction this new FCC is going. I was very hopeful after the 2008 elections, and we got a Democratic majority at the FCC, that a lot of the initiatives that I had been talking about to reassert the public interest and to put the brakes in consolidation and to protect the open internet would now go forth with three votes in the majority against two. But unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. So we have that majority now again, three and two. We have the opportunity to do something to preserve what's good in our media system and to correct what's bad. And if we don't take advantage of that, we are really playing fast and loose, not only with our media environment, but with our democracy.
I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. We're talking with Michael Copps. He's a former chair and former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission. John in Richland Center has been waiting to talk to us. Hi, John.
Hi. I was instrumental in creating the first network for General Electric in the early 80s, where you could email for the very first time, and then it went to the World Wide Web. I'm concerned about how much control does the FCC have over the Internet, because you have vices like pornography and Internet gambling, and the fact that you can send your MasterCard number over the Internet, and I know for a fact that you can hack any computer. That's my question.
Thanks, John.
Well, the FCC really decided, beginning back in 2002, shortly after I got there, but over my objections, that broadband, which is the technology that delivers the Internet to us, wasn't really going to be very much regulated. There wasn't going to be much public oversight. In fact, they weren't even going to call it telecommunications, because if they called it telecommunications, all sorts of things would apply to it, like privacy and public safety and requirements for E911 and requirements for universal service, making sure that everybody had broadband. Those are all things that applied to telephones, plain old telephone service, and most people thought applied to broadband too. And Congress didn't say you shall call broadband information services. Basically, the FCC decided that. So when they decided to call broadband, and I know this gets in the weeds, but this is what happened. When they decided to call broadband an information service instead of a telecommunications service, none of those safeguards, none of those protections automatically existed. So basically what you had was an unregulated Internet in a part of the law where the FCC had questionable jurisdiction. And just last month, the D.C. Circuit Court threw out the rather mild and milquetoast regulations the FCC had passed to supposedly protect the open Internet, and said, you can't do this if you're going to call this stuff an information service. The court also said if you had called it telecommunications, we probably would have approved that, and you could exert some regulation. So now this big question, it's the telecom question of the year before the FCC, is what's it going to do to exert some public oversight over the Internet? And again, this is not minute regulation. Nobody's trying to get in the way of the innovation and entrepreneurship and creativity of the Internet, but we are trying to make sure we don't have this monopoly, duopoly, oligopolistic, gatekeeping, toll booth kind of control that I've been talking about. I believe the FCC has some authority to do that, and the judges have now said that too, and now the question is, does the FCC have the courage to go ahead and reclassify broadband as a telecommunications service so that we can get on with the job? And it's an important job. I indicated before, if so much of our communications is moving on the Internet, if our town square of democracy is going to increasingly take place on broadband bricks, so to speak, then that becomes hugely invested with the public interest, and we have to have an intelligent discussion in this country, not shouting at each other or just hurling tirades at one another, but a reasoned discussion about how does this fit in with democracy as we go down the road? How is this communications infrastructure going to help us rather than hurt us? And who do we want to be in control of that? And are there some responsibilities when you wield that much power over how people communicate? Are there some responsibilities? Are there some limits to what you can do? That's what the debate over network neutrality, which I think is better termed internet freedom, that's what it's all about.
Is it too late for the FCC to reclassify what the internet is?
Could do it tomorrow morning. It could do it. It's almost
but
an invitation.
You mentioned some of the challenges that would come about if you were to classify it as a telecommunications.
Well, it's pending now because the court really said we threw your rules out because you based them on the wrong part of the statute. But had you done it over here, probably would have passed muster. So now it's up to the FCC. Will there be opposition? Will there be armies of special interest lobbyists and wheelbarrows full of money on the other side urging the commission not to do this and trying to urge Congress to call the FCC and say don't do this? Yes, there will. But I remain a believer that in the final analysis, grassroots power, the power of the people, can overcome this. And I know that sounds innocent to a lot of people or naive to a lot of people, but I've actually seen it happen. And if I can take a minute, I'll just give you one example. Back when I joined the commission, shortly after that, then Chairman Michael Powell, who now runs the Cable Industry Association in Washington, D.C., but as chairman, wanted to loosen the media ownership rules so that fewer companies could buy more and more outlets. And I think he and his colleagues saw this as kind of a inside-the-beltway thing. Who really cares about this out in the United States of America, how many outlets a company can own? And I and my colleague at that time, Jonathan Adelstein, who was another Democratic commissioner, said, wait a minute, why don't we go out and talk to the people? Why don't we have some hearings out in the countryside and see what people think of their local media? So we did that, and we went out and held a few meetings of our own. Powell wouldn't give us a lot of money or opportunity to do just FCC hearings. We did one or two, but then Jonathan and I latched on to hearings with some members of Congress, town hall meetings that they were holding, organizations like Common Cause and Free Press and several others, advocacy groups. We went to their meetings. In that summer of 2003, after those rules had been passed by the partisan FCC commission at that time, 3 million Americans, as a result of these hearings and just action at the grassroots, 3 million Americans wrote in saying we don't like those rules that the FCC passed. And the Senate actually voted twice to overturn those rules, and the House went on record against them too, and then the court sent them back as being deficient, which they obviously were. But my point here is that it was an issue in the countryside. We held these hearings. We came to places like Madison when all around the country, some of these meetings were attended by hundreds of people. One of them lasted 9 hours. A couple of them lasted 7 hours. People came out, said we're unhappy with the news we're getting. We're unhappy with the lack of diversity and all that. And I talked, I remember a conversation with a member of Congress who told me, he said, you know, I went home. He hadn't made up his mind yet, I think, on how he was going to vote when this question of what's going to happen to media ownership was those rules was taking place. He said, I went home and had a town hall meeting and somebody raised their hand and said, what about media ownership? And the member said to me, I never heard that issue raised in my life. Nobody was interested, I thought. But he heard about the issue and you know what he did? Came back and voted against the rules. So that told me that grassroots, even in this age when big money wields such outrageous control over everything we do, grassroots action can still make a difference. And that's what keeps me going after working in Washington for 40 years trying to do something about policies like this.
We're talking with Michael Copps, former chair and former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission and a special advisor to Common Cause's Media and Democracy Reform Initiative. He was in town last night, in Madison, that is, giving a talk called Defeating Dollarocracy, the Importance of Community Media. You're welcome to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. We'll be sure to get to your calls right after this. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the media landscape in the United States and its role in democracy with Michael Copps. He is a special advisor to Common Core's Media and Democracy Reform Initiative and a former commissioner and former chair of the Federal Communications Commission. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's talk to Kevin in Madison next. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning. I've been looking forward to this program, and I've worked in broadcasting over 45 years, and I said if I ever get to talk to someone from the FCC, I'm going to ask him this question directly. And you've touched on this in the last few minutes, but I worked in radio, and I can't figure out how in 96 that they were hoodwinked to think that consolidation of stations was going to increase. It seemed to be sold as it would increase employment opportunities. You know, when a radio station goes from one or two under one roof to eight, they don't hire eight more engineers or eight more sales staffs. They just ask the people there to work harder. And I said at the time, this isn't going to work. It's not going to increase opportunities. It's going to reduce opportunities. And in fact, it has, and it's also kept wage rates down because in one market, Cumulus isn't going to pay substantially more, for example, than Clear Channel or vice versa. So I hope your guest could speak a little bit more about that and maybe about LPFMs coming along. I think that's sort of a breath of fresh air.
Thanks, Kevin.
Well, I think you're right on target with talking about what happens with regard to employment. You know, it seems that not a week goes by and we don't read that even the big companies and networks like NBC or something are laying off news staffs. Now we see Time Magazine is consolidating its media stuff and downsizing and laying off people with its and reporting to the business office. So the story just goes on and on, as I said earlier. You know, these transactions cost money. They have to be financed. And all these CEOs and everybody keep coming into my office and say, oh, do this deal, approve this deal, and we're going to have all of these wonderful economies and efficiencies and all of that. And I'm looking around, and all the deals we approve, people are firing journalists and firing newsrooms and cutting back and closing bureaus, you know. How many of those big networks now have the bureaus overseas, for example, that they had 20 years ago? And I was a kid growing up in Milwaukee. I think our first TV set was like a little 7-inch Motorola, and we used to watch John Cameron Swayze or Doug Edwards on the 15-minute black and white news. And now we look back on that as so quaint. And it was in many ways, but John Cameron Swayze and Doug Edwards had bureaus with reporters in London and Paris and Bonn and Rome and Tokyo, all around the world, and he knew who was reporting from those places and the expertise they have. Now you turn on the evening news, the full color, half hour, you know, all the news you need to know, which is really a lot of glitzy infotainment. And when they do go to the bureau overseas, it's maybe a stringer that they've hired to do this program because it costs so much less than to run a bureau over there. The same thing has happened in state house bureaus here in the United States of America. They've cut back so much reporting on the state houses that some of these state legislatures are getting away with murder and it's going unreported and they're not being held accountable. You raise a wonderful point on low power, and this is a part of the whole media infrastructure we haven't talked about. It's public media, public radio, public television, community radio and television, low power FM. The commission did good things at the behest of Congress, particularly in the leadership of Congressman Mike Doyle from Pennsylvania, but with a lot of help from a lot of friends to pass, to urge really to pass legislation to open a window for more low-power stations across the country. We've got about 800 of them, I think, on the air right now. We should have thousands, and that window is opening, and I'm hoping that at the end of it we will have doubled or tripled low-power radio. We've got to take advantage of every alternative media avenue that we can find. We have to think about increasing our national support for public broadcast. In the United States of America, everybody listening to this show this morning is contributing maybe $1.35 every year for the support of public broadcasting. In other countries, it's $50, $80, $100, $200, some $400. And I'm not saying that we should mimic the exact systems that they have over there, but it's such a paltry sum that we put in to public broadcasting. And by the way, that right away, as soon as I say that, someone will say, well, we don't want government controlling our media. But if you look at the rankings that come out every year of democracy rankings, which countries are doing best in encouraging real small-d democracy, the ones that are ahead of the United States of America, many of them, have really heavy support for public media. So you put up firewalls. You make sure nobody is controlling it, but you give those stations the resources that they need. So public broadcast, we have to have an intelligent discussion about that in this country. We have to look at nonprofit incentives for nonprofit newspapers, nonprofit media, nonprofit online initiatives. The IRS has been kind of asleep at the switch in approving requests for nonprofit media outlets. It needs to get on the job and approve them, and we need to go down that road. We need, with PEG, public and educational and governmental stations, to make sure that they're there. They were in the law. They were envisioned by the Telecommunications Act. But what you have now with a lot of these special interest bills going around in different states, easing up on the cable franchising requirements, you see a lot of PEG stations not surviving. And where they do survive, you see a lot of the big cable companies and putting them up in tiers where a viewer can never find them, you know, on channel 4028 or something like that. Lots of luck of even finding it. So we need to be moving in all of those fronts, but we shouldn't see them as the sole solution. It's something we should be doing. It's something we must be doing. But the other part of that solution is to get serious on the full power stations and stop that consolidation and put some public interest back into our oversight of where the FCC has oversight.
Let's talk to Joe in Milwaukee. Joe, what's your question or comment?
Yes, hi. It's an excellent show. But the longer I listen to it, the more I feel that it's too little too late. As your guest has pointed out rightly, you can't have democracy or a healthy democracy without good public communication at all levels. And he mentioned just a few moments ago about, for example, the BBC, the CBC, the ABC, other networks around the world that spend a great deal of public money because they want an independent channel or station that's going to give people a balanced view. And certainly I feel that. I mean, I basically only listen to public television or public radio because I've lived abroad, I've lived in Canada, I've lived in Europe, and I find the media generally in this country is appalling. It's almost comparable to, you know, the financing of Congress. In other words, the entire society has been taken over by these corporations at all levels. And I don't see how our democracy can survive. And that's why I'm saying I saw recently, not too long ago, that only about 4 or 5% of Wisconsinites even listen to public radio or television, which is frightening in itself. In other words, I'm wondering if we've been so dumbed down now that there's really little hope of reversing this dismal reality.
What do you think?
Well, I hope it's not too little too late. Yes, I think the civic dialogue has been dumbed down. I have used that term to dangerous levels. The country has dug itself into a very deep hole economically and jobs-wise and in many respects social-wise, too. There's no get-out-of-jail-free card. There's no get-out-of-the-hole-free card for the United States of America. We have to make some really intelligent decisions as a people about the future of the country if we're going to get our leadership back, and that depends upon having a vibrant civic dialogue. So, yes, it's late in the game. Yes, the forces in opposition to that are heavily funded. But no, I don't think it's too late. If I did, I think I would have just retired from the FCC and gone off and lived happily ever after and not been involved with these issues anymore. But when you stop and think about it, the reforms that this country needs and has had historically have taken a long time to come, whether you're talking about abolition and slavery, you know, many, many years that we debated that, and finally the we'd have a war to settle the issue, but that happened. Women's rights, long crusade, still going on, but it took generations and generations. Worker rights, LGBT rights, you can go all up and down the line. And here's what I found. You know, I've spent all these years in government trying to make sure that we could have good laws, good regulations coming from Washington. And you can do some things that way, but the real systemic stuff, the real stuff that makes a difference in this country, that opens the doors of opportunity, that that really builds cultural diversity, economic opportunity, a vibrant political dialogue, those things are going to come in the final analysis from the people. My point is that media democracy is so important to the future of democracy. And, I go around the country speaking a lot, and a lot of times I'll go around the room and there'll be a bunch of people there, and I'll say, what do you think is the biggest challenge facing the United States of America right now? And someone will say, well, it's jobs. And somebody else will say it's 50 million people who don't have health insurance. Someone will say it's the lack of equal opportunity for minorities and diversities. And the list goes on. And I say those answers are all well and good and great. But none of those challenges is going to be solved until the media explains what those challenges are to the American people. Until we have a media that is capable of doing that and conducts an intelligent dialogue and allows people to inform themselves so they can make up their minds about the future of the country. So you can, you can keep that number one issue, but you ought to put right alongside it, or at least number two, this media issue, because none of those other problems are going to get resolved until the people have an understanding of the importance of the issue. That's the order of the day.
Well, Daryl in Bloomington might have a point on that. If, Daryl, you could just be a bit brief. We are short on time.
Yeah, broadcasting has the latent resources to revive America's economy like nothing else that we possess. This work is in the self-interest of commercial broadcasting, public broadcasting, and print media, because it will help us get jobs now in the in the air conditioning field. They've run survey tests, and they're only getting 63% of the BTUs delivered to the rooms and half of the airflow they need. And we need to educate consumers. The power that this has is unbelievable when it's merged with the Internet.
And Daryl, thank you for your comment. We are short on time. I wanted to ask you, Michael Copps, though, going back to a point you just made. You likened the effort to open up media airwaves to a more democratic treatment to the women's movement or the civil rights movement. But when I think about those historical moments and how much effort they took and some of the, the impetus for those movements, oppression is at the core center. Do you feel that people actually feel oppressed, though, by today's media well enough to spark a movement? And I'm sorry to toss you that big question with just 1 minute left to go.
I think more than you think, because we went around the country not expecting a lot of people to show up at these town hall meetings and other meetings that we had, and hundreds would be there. And they, even though media wasn't telling them what the problem was, because big media doesn't like to talk about itself, obviously, so it doesn't. So what the people know, they get through community media and through the grassroots and these other routes, not from not from big media itself, but yes, those people reacted. They knew something was wrong. They knew they weren't getting the news. We talked to diversity groups, and just, you know, on the verge of tears that they weren't being covered. I talked about those 3 million people who wrote to the FCC. So if we can tee these issues up so that people can understand them, I think they would want to do something about them. I'm convinced they'd want to do something about it, and if they didn't, I wouldn't still be working at this.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been great being on, and thanks to your visitors, and I like your listeners. I like that BTUs and airflow analogy.
A lot of analogies.
So let's get some media BTUs and airflow going here.
I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is the Ideas Network.